I invite you to open your Bibles to Acts chapter 21 this evening. We will begin our study there. It's good to see everyone out. We're thankful for visitors again this evening. I've been talking about this lesson, working on it for a while, and there's a lot of information that I'm going to try to condense, and I hope I don't leave out something important. You know, if you ask somebody to talk about their hobby, about their family, about something they like to do, they can go on for hours and hours and hours talking about it. Sometimes when we come to talking about something about the Bible, we draw a blank because we don't talk about it enough. We aren't familiar with it. It's not second nature. So, as I've been trying to every couple of weeks do a lesson from the book of Acts, Acts is key. It's the hub of the Bible. It deals with the conversions. Paul is the central character in Acts, which he wrote half the New Testament. So the more we learn about Paul and his travels and how Acts fits into the Bible, the more we can explain the Bible to others. The passage I am using for our text, "So you must also bear witness at Rome," Acts 23:11. "But the following night the Lord stood by him and said, 'Be of good cheer, Paul, for you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome.'" So we're going to look briefly at the later chapters in the book of Acts, some of the highlights, and see this journey that Paul went on. On the handout, I have an outline of the chapters, I have his defenses, and on the second sheet, the Herods of Palestine. So if you're going to make any notes, I would suggest you make notes on these sheets. This outline doesn't follow exactly the order of the sermon, and then just fold it up for a further study. So when we look at this, we're going to see that there are five defenses that Paul gave toward the end of the book of Acts. We're going to look at the background of this trip. We're going to look at the characters. We're going to look at some places. In Acts 9:15, "But the Lord said to him, 'Go, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear my name before Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. For I will show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake.'" Some of the characters that we are going to see in this lesson: Agabus, the prophet; Lysias, the chief captain; the Sanhedrin, that was composed of Pharisees and Sadducees; Paul's nephew; Felix, the governor; and Drusilla, his wife; Ananias, the high priest; Tertullus, the Jewish lawyer to plead the case against Paul; Festus, the procurator of Judea; and King Agrippa and Bernice. So we have this outline, which I'm not going to go over it chapter by chapter since you have a copy of that, but just a couple highlights to mention. So we're familiar with Acts chapter 20 when Paul met with the elders at Ephesus. And when he was there, it is interesting that he was in a hurry to get to Jerusalem for the Pentecost feast. Following that, as he is going to Jerusalem, we come upon Agabus again. He's mentioned in chapter 11, but he is the one that warned Paul not to go to Jerusalem. And I think it was back in chapter 11 where he took off Paul's belt and bound his hands, and he said, "The person that this belongs to, he is going to be bound and taken to Jerusalem." We see the different characters, and again, Paul going to Rome to fulfill what Christ said to him when he appeared, that he would speak to Gentiles and to kings. When we look at Rome, in 63 BC, Rome gained possession of Palestine. And how did the Roman rule affect the Jews? Well, Rome brought peace to the whole world. How did they bring peace? by being the chief law enforcer. The Jews were allowed political liberty and self-government. As much as possible, Rome worked through the local rules. They required to pay a yearly tax, and Rome constructed roads. So the Roman Empire controlled Palestine, and then Rome would put their officials throughout Palestine to keep the peace. One group of those individuals were the Herods, the rulers of Palestine. Herod is a name used by several kings belonging to the Herodian dynasty of the Roman province of Judea. Again, you can trace the Herods back to the Old Testament, descendants of Edom. So basically, they were distant relatives with the Israelites. You had Herod the Great, Herod Antipas, Archelaus, Philip, Agrippa the First. The next one isn't too much said about him, and Herod Agrippa the Second. So you have the Herods, and there's a lot of political things going on at this time with the Romans, with the Jews, with the different laws. And with the Romans, they had the Caesars that ruled. The first one listed on here from 102 to 101 BC was Julius Caesar. He died in 44 BC. And then it goes on down to the time of Paul with Nero. Luke 2:3 records, "And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed." The census was going to be taken. Again, Rome ruled the world. And it's very interesting to see the providence of God. So the providence of God is going to use the Roman government to transport Paul to proclaim the gospel to a governor, a king, and a Caesar. If Paul had tried to go there himself, how would he have gotten there? How would he have paved the way? It's the providence of God that takes him there. A couple trigger words to look for as you're going through these chapters. Two of them, the Gentiles and the Pharisees. And when you see those words used, as I have illustrated up here, it's like pouring gasoline on a fire. It's explosive. Whenever Paul would mention the Gentiles, the Jews would get in an uproar, because the Jews looked down on the Gentiles. They looked at them as dogs. The word Pharisee, that was one of the two major sects, the Pharisees and Sadducees. Whenever when Paul would mention that he was a Pharisee, that would turn the Sadducees against the Pharisees. So these were little trigger words. He would say that, and it would trigger some big event happening. So in chapter 21, Paul went up to Jerusalem, even though he was warned not to by the brethren and the prophet Agabus. He went to the temple. He made a vow, and the Jews accused him of polluting the temple, bringing Gentiles into the temple. So right there is a trigger word, a trigger word. What happened? There is this big uproar in chapter 21, where Paul was arrested in the temple. And from different things that I've read, part of the temple, it was so huge and the steps were so large leading up to it, some of those areas could easily accommodate 20,000 people on the steps outside the temple. So Paul had this discussion as he was being arrested. So that brings us to our first defense from the steps in Acts 22. Paul made a defense before the Jewish mob. When he was dealing with the Gentiles, this mob arose, accused him of polluting the temple. Paul was arrested, taken into the castle to be questioned. And Paul told the chief captain Lysias that he was a Roman. So here's an artist's rendition of Paul addressing the angry crowd in Jerusalem. Again, it would have been a large gathering. So when he mentions to Chief Captain Lysias that he was a Roman, that is going to set off another thing that is going to play into this. He wasn't just anybody. He was a Roman citizen. He had Roman rights as a citizen. He has his second defense before the Sanhedrin. So as you can see on this outline, it's a brief outline. It's not going to go into any of the charges or the arguments back and forth, but just so we become familiar with the timeline of what transpires, Paul spoke to the Jewish council. The high priest had Paul slapped in the face. There is a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees. The Jews physically attacked Paul. The chief captain rescued Paul by arresting him. So in Acts 23 and verse 9, then there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes of the Pharisees' party arose and protested, saying, "We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God." So when Paul stood up and said that he was a Pharisee, that got all of the Pharisees on the Sanhedrin on his side. The Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection. They didn't believe in angels. So when the Pharisees started speaking, "We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or angel has spoken to him," so they're calling out the Sadducees, "let us not fight against God." Now, when there arose a great dissension, the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the barracks. Verse 11, but the following night the Lord stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness in Rome." And when it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Now there were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy. So you see this hatred that is growing against Paul. Chapter 23 continued. Paul's nephew learns of this plot of the Jews to kill his uncle, and he warns the chief captain. The chief captain got 470 men to escort Paul to Caesarea. The chief captain didn't go, but he sent a letter addressed to Felix. So in Acts 23:23, notice, and he called for two centurions. So a centurion is a officer over 100 soldiers. So two centurions, 200 soldiers, saying, "Prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night and provide mounts to set Paul on and bring him safely to Felix, the governor." Why would it take 470 men to take this prisoner to Caesarea? Because he knew it was a very touchy situation, to say the least. Here is a picture of what some of the barracks were like at that time, the remains of one. Here's a picture of, this is just about a dozen Roman soldiers here. But in one of the verses, it talks about they carried him. They would have to surrounded Paul, because if they let something happen to Paul, it would have been their life that was taken also. But that would have been a very formidable presence. 470 soldiers for this one man to escort him to Caesarea. The Roman soldiers were well trained for situations as this. The commander must have sensed the situation was escalating, ordered the chained prisoner to be carried in order to hasten their retreat. So he was taken. Why did they go to Caesarea? This is one of Herod's palaces, as we see here at Caesarea. And there's the layout of the area. And you can see in the yellow on the screen some of the highlighted things. The Hippodrome, where they would flood that and have naval games there. And part of it was used as a prison. They supposed that might have been where Paul was held at that time, and then the rest of the area there. And if you look on the other page with the Herods, and you see from Luke 3 and Mark 6, Herod Philip the first, Herodias was his wife. He was in Caesarea Philippi. He rebuilt that area, named it to honor Caesar and himself. And that was a stronghold of Caesar worship. And that's where they were taking Paul to hold him as prisoner. Now, again, if we don't talk about this much, it's not familiar, and it doesn't roll off our tongues like talking about our family all day long. When you bring in the Herods, that is another family that is difficult to understand at times. When you look at number 4 on the second page, Herodias, that was married to Herod Philip, she was the wicked granddaughter of Herod the Great, the sister of Herod Agrippa the First, married her uncle Herod Philip, then married other uncle Herod Antipas. She told her daughter to ask for the head of John the Baptizer. So basically, when you look at the Herods, to put it in plain language, they were a power-hungry family. Herod the Great killed many of his family members so that he could be in position. He wanted all the male babies under 2 years old killed so that they would not be a threat to him as a king. You see incest, adultery throughout the Herod family, intermarrying in the family, living in open adultery. So you have, and these would be what we would call, for lack of a better term, the religious leaders of Palestine, appointed by Roman rule, that were ungodly, but they knew of the Israelites and the old law. But this brings us to our third defense, the speech before Governor Felix in Acts 24. Now, Felix the governor held Paul 5 days until Ananias, the high priest, Jewish elders, and their order, Tertullus, arrived to accuse Paul. After the Jews' accusations, Felix allowed Paul to speak. Felix decided to keep Paul under arrest until he had personally from Chief Captain Lysias. So they were following a certain protocol. He gives a speech to Felix. Felix wants more information from the high priest. And then also, when they send for information from the high priest, after 5 days, Ananias the high priest descended with the elders and with a certain orator named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul. So this orator, this lawyer, was basically hired by the Jews to plead their case against Paul, because they wanted him dead. They wanted him dead. Again, this would have been a big formal political hearing where he was summoned and Tertullus began to accuse him. This is a picture from a time, fresco of Cicero denouncing this other person. This would have been something of their tribunal there. Again, you think about the number of the soldiers that were involved. The commander Lysias came and with great violence took him away out of our hands. 24 verse 7. So it's not just Paul coming and going, but there are all of these soldiers that are going to be around guarding him. So his third defense, the speech before Governor Felix. While under arrest, Paul had the opportunity to speak to Felix and his wife Drusilla about righteousness, temperance, and the judgment to come. Felix trembled. Why do you think he trembled? Was it just such a stirring sermon that it touched his heart and made him think about righteousness and temperance and things to come? Paul knew, he knew this man Felix. He would have been well known. His character was well known. He knew the sins that he were involved in, and Paul went straight at that and addressed those. 2 years passed. Paul was still bound by Governor Felix. The account records that he was hoping to please the Jews by keeping Paul and also getting money for releasing him. So Felix was a poor excuse of a governor and was willing to take bribes and led a very immoral lifestyle. So when we look at Felix and Drusilla, Felix and his brother had been slaves in the household of the mother of Emperor Claudius. Claudius elevated Felix from the position of slave to that of ruler over the province of Judea. So he had grown up as a slave, and he was promoted to ruler over Judea. Drusilla was the daughter of Herod Agrippa, who murdered James, died a horrible death in AD 44, and at the same time she was six years old. At an early age, she became the wife of a king. A lot of these marriages were arranged, and then again, you had multiple husbands, wives, partners, a very immoral arrangement. So Paul knew what to preach to Felix to make him tremble. Josephus tells us that Drusilla exceeded all other women in beauty, and when Felix was governor or procurator of Judea, he fell in love with her. And again, as any of the politicians back then, some of them today, they see something, what do? They take it. They take it. Felix trembled. Nothing, this is a commentary from J.W. McGarvey, nothing could be more terrifying than to speak of righteousness to a man of such iniquity, of temperance in all things to a man of such unbridled lust, or to drive home what was said on these topics by depicting the judgment to come. So this was a man, he didn't control his lust, his passions at all, and Paul's preaching to him on temperance, on self-control. And he's telling him about this judgment that he's going to be facing. And Felix trembled. You think about all the private murders that he had committed, the public massacres. He was ruling for 8 years in the government, first of Samaria, then of Palestine. So again, nothing much has changed in the history of mankind, the things that take place with corrupt rulers and immoral men. So then that brings us where he is before Festus, his fourth defense, the speech before Governor Festus in Acts 25. Festus was the procurator of Judea from about AD 60 to 62. Felix was called by Rome due to his violent, his ineffective intervention and riots. Basically, he wasn't a good ruler. He wasn't good person to keep the peace. These riots would spring up between the Jews and the Gentiles, the inhabitants of Caesarea, so he was called back. The historian Tacitus says about Felix, he exercised the authority of a king with the mind of a slave. Acts 25 and verse 23, and on the morrow, when Agrippa came with Bernice with great pomp and was entered into the place of hearing with chief captains and principal men of the city, at Festus' commandment, Paul was brought forth. Again, here in Caesarea, Herod Agrippa II ruled over the former territory of Herod Philip, the Tetrarch, which ran along the northeast borders of Festus' province. This capital was at Caesarea Philippi. Bernice was a sister. This sounds like a nighttime drama, a daytime soap opera. everybody, the connection between the two, where their lands are located, their jurisdictions are located, the corruption back and forth. Herod Agrippa II was 17 years old when his father died in AD 44, back in Acts chapter 12. He was known to be an expert in all matters of affecting Jewish religion. For example, among other things, he had the right of appointing and deposing the Jewish high priest. In 25:24, Festus said, "King Agrippa and all men which are here are present with us. Ye see this man, about whom all the multitude of the Jews have dealt with me, both at Jerusalem and also here, crying that he ought not to live any longer." And when you read these speeches in detail, some of them are really heavy, laying it on in language to slant things. But when I found out that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and that he himself had appealed to Augustus, I have determined to send him, of whom I have no certain thing to write unto my Lord. Wherefore I brought him forth before you, and specially before thee, O King Agrippa, that after examination had, I might have somewhat to write. For it seemed to me unreasonable to send a prisoner, and not withal to signify the crimes laid against him. So we come to the fifth defense before Agrippa and Bernice in Acts 26. Then Agrippa said unto Paul, "Thou art permitted to speak for thyself." Agrippa had been brought up in the Jewish faith, and on this account had been entrusted by the emperor with the oversight of religious affairs in Jerusalem, while Judea was under Roman procurators. Then Paul stretched forth his hand and answered for himself, "I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because I shall answer for myself this day before thee, touching all the things whereof I am accused of the Jews, especially because I know thee to be an expert in all customs and questions which are among the Jews, wherefore I beseech thee to hear me. My manner of life from my youth, which was at first among mine own nation at Jerusalem, know all the Jews, which knew me from the beginning, if they would testify after that the most straitest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. And now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers, and to which our promise our 12 tribes, instantly serving God day and night, hope to come. For which hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused of the Jews." And then Festus interrupts, and he spoke for himself. Festus said with a loud voice, "Paul, you're beside yourself. Much learning doth make thee mad." But he said, "I am not mad, most noble Festus, but speak forth the words of truth and soberness. For the king knoweth of these things, before whom also I speak freely. For I am persuaded that none of these things are hidden from him. For this thing was not done in a corner." And you think about this too, when you look over all of those Herods and over Paul and the Sanhedrin in the city of Jerusalem, it would be like we say today, everybody knows what's going on in Washington. Everybody knows. Everybody knew what was going on in Jerusalem. Everybody knew. "King Agrippa, believest thou the prophets? I know that thou believest." Then Agrippa said unto Paul, "Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian." Paul said, "I would to God that not only thou, but also all that hear me this day, were both almost and altogether such as I am, except these bonds." This is the lesson we just had recently, what it means to be a Christian like Paul. And when he had thus spoken, the king rose up, and the governor Bernice, and they that sat with him. And when they had gone aside, they talked between themselves, saying, "This man doth nothing worthy of death or of bonds." Then said Agrippa unto Festus, "This man might have been set at liberty if he had not appealed unto Caesar." It's interesting to see this later time in Paul's life and the events that transpired from when he went to Jerusalem and took some Gentiles to the temple, and he made a vow, and the Jews turned into a mob, and then all the events that transpired following that. They wanted to kill him. These 40 men took a vow, we aren't going to eat till we kill Paul. He's shifted, transported from one place to another under Roman guard. He's speaking before all these men, and all of them can say, we find nothing that he's worthy of death. And why did he appeal to Caesar? Because if he had not appealed to Caesar and was released, the Jews would have killed him. The Roman government wouldn't have been able to stop them. That's why the captain had 470 men protecting him when they transported him. But notice again the providence of God. Back in Acts 9:15, but the Lord said to him, go, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear my name before Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. In Acts 23:11, but the Lord, the following night, the Lord stood by him and said, be of good cheer, Paul, for you have testified for me in Jerusalem. You also must bear witness of me in Rome. One other passage I left out, but in Acts 22 and verse 21, well, I'll read 18 and then 21. And he saw him saying to me, this is Christ speaking, Paul relating it, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me. You drop down to verse 21. Then he said to me, this is the Lord speaking, depart, for I will send you far away from here to the Gentiles. Paul is told by the Lord that he is going far away from there to the Gentiles. He's going to Rome. He's going to Rome to bear witness of Christ. He's got one last trip to make after he's in Rome. And we don't have the record of his defense before Caesar, or any details about his execution. History says that he was put to death by being beheaded, but he had one last departure to make after all of these on this trip. And he writes to Timothy about it in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 6. I'm already being poured out as a drink offering. The time of my departure is at hand. I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. You see how Paul put his life in the hands of the Lord and trusted him. He was willing to endure all the mistreatment, the beatings, the sufferings, the trials that he went to, because he knew that what was waiting for him was greater than what he would have to go through. And when he is writing to Timothy from prison in Rome, he knows the end of his life is over. I have fought the good fight. Friends, are we fighting the good fight? We can't be bystanders. We can't be spectators. We've got to fight the fight. I have finished the race. Some people haven't started the race. We got to ask ourselves, how are we running? Are we not running but walking, or are we going backwards? We got to ask ourselves that. I've kept the faith. I've kept the faith. I have done what God wants me to do. Finally, there's laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord himself, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day. And as we were talking this morning from 1 Thessalonians about when the day of the Lord, when Christ comes back, and what a comfort that will be for those of us that are in Christ and those that have hope. It doesn't matter what happens to us in this life if we have hope. And that's where our happiness is connected to. Our peace is that hope being in Christ. And not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. Friends, Paul is a great example for us to follow Christ as he followed Christ, to trust in God's providence. Again, there's no way except the providence of God that Paul could have gotten from Jerusalem to appear before Caesar if those events had not transpired in between. We need to be like Paul and live for Christ and be ready to die for Christ. Friends, if there's anyone here this evening that has sin in your life, you need to ask for prayers. You need to make public confession. You need to name the Lord in baptism. If we can assist you in any way, we invite you to come forward now as we stand and sing.